This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Hal Brands is the Henry Kissinger Distinguished Professor of Global Affairs at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He is also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Hal joins us today to talk about his book on the history of grand strategy and how to apply the lessons of that history to today. We'll be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters. The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io. Hal, welcome back to Intelligence Matters. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So Hal, I want to talk about a book that you edited titled The New Makers of Modern Strategy. The book was published in May of last year, and I think it's timeless. I think anyone interested in foreign affairs should read it. They should have it on their bookshelf. I have it on mine. So I would encourage everybody to go out and buy it wherever you buy your books. I want to start, Hal, with a book because I think it really provides a lot of insights to some of the issues we're trying to deal with today. So we'll start with the book and then try to draw out some of the lessons for today. Can I ask you to start, Hal, by describing what the book does? And in doing so, can you say a few words about the impressive roster of authors for the individual chapters?
Sure. So I'll actually start there. You know, some books are individual efforts. This one is the very opposite. And so this is a book where I rounded up 45 of my closest friends and begged them to write chapters on aspects of strategy, its practice, its intellectual history, its future, in areas that they knew best. And so it's no exaggeration to say that this is an utterly all-star cast of historians, political scientists, scholars, think tankers, former practitioners, so on and so forth, really a who's who of people in the field. And they write about issues ranging from Thucydides and the way that he is still interpreted today to Clausewitz to Qasem Soleimani and Kim Jong-un. And so this is really a book that is meant to be relevant to people wrestling with the dilemmas of strategy today by giving them leverage on how it has been practiced both in the recent past and the more distant past. And I should mention as well that the book itself has a past. And so this is called The New Makers of Modern Strategy because it's actually the third installment in a longer running franchise. And so the original Makers of Modern Strategy was published in 1943. And it was meant to basically educate Americans and citizens of other democratic countries in the realities of strategy and the realities of military affairs at a time in the middle of World War II when this could hardly have been more important. There was then a second volume that came out in 1986, which basically updated our understanding of strategy in light of some of the challenges of the Cold War. And so the rationale for doing a third volume with Princeton Press was that clearly we are entering into a new, increasingly contested era in world politics in which a lot of the dangers that we thought we had gotten past, the danger of great power war, the danger of nuclear crises, the danger that aggressive autocratic regimes will get the ascendancy, those are coming back in a big way. And so it made sense to refresh our understanding of strategy for this new era.
So I guess since we're going to talk about strategy, how do you define it? What is it?
Everybody's got a definition of strategy, and I think the people who contribute to this volume probably have different definitions of strategy. I try to keep it simple. I think of strategy as the art of getting what you want with what you have in a world that seems set on denying you. And so it's about figuring out how you achieve big consequential objectives with limited resources in a world that presents you with living, thinking adversaries and lots of other actors that are out there trying to frustrate your designs. And so it's a relatively simple definition, but it's not a simple task.
Yeah, for sure. You wrote an introduction to the book called The Indispensable Art. Tell us about what you wrote there, and in particular, tell us about the word indispensable and the word art.
Sure. So let me start with those two pieces. I picked indispensable because there's really no substitute for strategy, as I point out at the very beginning of the book. Because we live in a competitive world, because we live in a world where it is difficult for nations to achieve their aims, because we live in a world where there are bad actors that are trying to achieve their aims and frustrate yours, you have to do strategy in order to thrive and perhaps even to survive. You can't just sort of pick your moves randomly. You can't simply react to events. If you do that, that's a recipe for national failure and, depending on what country you are, perhaps national extinction. And so strategy has long been indispensable in that sense. It's an art in the sense that there are no sort of fundamental fixed principles of strategy that you can just sort of take off the shelf and apply in one era as you applied them in the prior era. This is frustrating for many students of strategy. William Tecumseh Sherman, a variety of other American military thinkers have tried to sort of deduce laws of strategy that could be applied in a particular context. The challenge, of course, is that just stuff doesn't work that way. The United States is not going to be successful waging competitions against Russia and China by simply replaying the Cold War playbook that it used against the Soviet Union. But there are things that you can learn from the Cold War or from other historical periods that can help inform your understanding of, you know, how the United States does strategy, how other countries do strategies, where the United States tends to succeed and where it tends to struggle. And all of those can feed into better judgment. And this is really where kind of the art comes in, because ultimately strategy is a matter of judgment. It can be informed by historical experience, but it has to be applied in cases that are never quite like what came before.
Is there a difference between strategy and tactics?
I think so. And so the sort of the old distinction between strategy and tactics basically ran like this, that tactics was the use of troops to win the battle, so to speak, or win the engagement. You know, how do you take the hill? And strategy is the use of the engagement to win the war, right? How do you put things together? That was kind of the Clausewitz definition, or the Clausewitz distinction between tactics and strategy. I think that still holds, although our understanding of strategy has broadened quite a lot over time. And so, now our understanding of strategy encompasses economic issues, diplomatic issues. We sometimes talk about grand strategy, which is meant to weave all of these things together. So sort of the definition has shifted over time, but I think that basic distinction is still useful.
Yeah. So when you read the 45 chapters, right, what are the lessons learned about strategy that you take away and, you know, you'd like the readers to take away? And lessons, you know, about good strategy, lessons about bad strategy, right? How do you think about that?
One lesson that may be worth talking about in the current context is that strategy can never be divorced from politics, and strategy can never be divorced either from sort of domestic politics, as we often think about it, or politics in the sense of the nature of the regime of the country that pursues it. And so if you think about strategic projects or strategic innovations in the past, they were often downstream of the political or ideological makeup of the country that pursued them. And so Napoleon's military innovations, the innovations that came out of the French Revolution more broadly, were related to the profound political, social, ideological changes that revolution wrought on French society, and particularly the way it made it possible to mobilize larger pools of manpower than had ever really appeared on the battlefields of the era before. If you think about the great totalitarian regimes of the 20th century, Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia, to provide a couple of examples, the programs of global transformation, of global revolution they pursued were intimately related to the programs of domestic revolution that they pursued at home. And the other way that this kind of comes out in the volume is that when you look at this many cases over time, it allows you to evaluate what sort of polity, what sort of political system is best at making strategy. And I think the encouraging thing that I take away from the book, as well as a bunch of other history, is that in general, democracies tend to do it better. Yes, there are tactical advantages that come with being an autocratic regime. You can mount a surprise attack on the country next door in a way that you probably can't do if you are the United States or another democratic system. But democracies make better judgments over time because they have better mechanisms for holding their leaders accountable, and they have better mechanisms for replacing leaders who are taking the country in a bad direction. And so it's easy to find autocratic regimes that went on a really good 5-year run or a good 10-year run or an even 20-year run. It's harder to find ones that have gone on a good 250-year run in the way that the United States has. And so I think that's one important lesson that comes out of the book.
So Hal, you and I exchanged some emails a little while ago where you shared some thoughts about how specific chapters can relate and can give us insight on strategy today, you know, with regard to the issues we're dealing with. Can you just share a couple of those that stand out to you?
Yeah, one I think that was particularly important was a chapter that a scholar named Tammy Davis Biddle at the Army War College wrote on coalition management during World War II. And she focused in particular on the roles of Roosevelt and Churchill. And I think that there were two big insights that came out of this that are relevant today. The first is kind of an adaptation of the old Georges Clemenceau aphorism that strategy is too important to be left to the generals. He said war is too important to be left to the generals, but the same point holds, because when you think about what went into bringing victory for the Grand Alliance during World War II, it involved so much more than sort of a pure political military calculus or a pure expertise in military affairs. It involved diplomacy at the highest levels, thinking about how to manage this very fractious coalition. It involved thinking about how you allocated economic resources and manpower in the most efficient way. So should the U.S. mobilize 215 divisions, or should it mobilize 90 divisions and hold back the remainder of its manpower for service and industry and that sort of thing? It involved thinking about trade-offs across theaters that really qualified as continental wars in their own right. And so the greatest leaders, the greatest strategists in these wars were not, you know, Eisenhower or Marshall or their equivalents on the British side, as great as some of those figures were. They were really the civilian leaders that had to play the role of sort of military chief, but also chief diplomat, chief economist, and so on and so forth. The second thing that comes out of this is just how crucial coalition management is as a tool of strategy for the United States. Twice in the 20th century, the U.S. decided that it had to redress an imbalance of power in Eurasia by going to war there. And in both cases, it was only able to succeed by joining coalitions, joining alliances that added their strengths to America's own. It came in late, obviously, in World War I, but played a pretty important role there. Played an even more important role in World War II. And the thing that Roosevelt certainly considered to be his most important job during World War II was keeping the Grand Alliance together, right? Even if that meant tolerating Soviet misbehavior in various ways, even if that meant having to adjudicate some pretty difficult disputes, because he knew it was the only way that an offshore power like the United States could bring decisive influence to bear on the Eurasian supercontinent. And the reason that's so important is that is still totally true today. And so if you think that the United States still has a compelling interest in preventing bad actors, hostile powers, from dominating key regions of Eurasia, whether that's Eastern Europe or the Middle East or East Asia, it can only do that in concert with local powers that have chosen to fuse their efforts to those of the United States. And so alliances remain the secret sauce of U.S. policy, and alliance management is really the most vital task of American strategy.
So, Hal, I want to, if it's okay, get specific a little bit on the issues that we're struggling with and dealing with today. And the first one I want to talk about is China, if that's okay. Chapter 39 is on Xi strategy, which I think is a particularly important chapter. Can you chat about that a little bit?
Sure. That chapter was written by Liz Economy, who is a very distinguished China scholar and has served some time in the U.S. government as well, working on China policy. And there is a lot to like in that chapter. It's a really detailed description of the various ways in which Xi has raised China's level of global ambition during the time that he has been in command in Beijing. But what I actually take away from the chapter is perhaps something a bit unusual. And so we often focus on Xi Jinping as this atypical character, as this guy who sort of came along and revolutionized Chinese statecraft and adopted a much more confrontational line toward the West and toward the United States. And all of that is true to a certain extent. But there's two important contextual points to keep in mind, which I think help us make sense of the challenge that China poses. And the first is that the assertive turn in Chinese statecraft in this century did not start under Xi Jinping. It started under his predecessor, Hu Jintao, really in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, which a lot of Chinese analysts overinterpreted as signaling sort of the terminal decline of the United States and its world order. And that was when we started to see more assertive behavior in the South China Sea and things like that. But the deeper history of this is that the idea of China's national rejuvenation, this idea that Xi Jinping pushes with great fervency, is much more deeply rooted in China's history. And so Liz traces sort of the way that this phrase and this idea has evolved over time. But the takeaway from my perspective is that when Chinese leaders talk about the country's trajectory, they don't really think of it as a China that is rising on the international stage for the first time. They think of it as a China that is returning to its rightful place atop the international pyramid of power, a position that in the Chinese telling it held for hundreds and hundreds of years, and perhaps even longer than that, when it was the most powerful country in Asia and one of the most powerful countries in the world. And it was only in the 19th century, when this century of humiliation began and China found itself ravaged by foreign powers and internally divided and so on and so forth. And so what it reminds us is that while we can tie ourselves in knots debating the precise extent and nature of China's ambitions, this idea that China is a special place, right, that it is the Middle Kingdom, that it has almost a historic right to lead the world, to lead Asia, certainly, it's very deeply rooted in Chinese statecraft. And so that probably tells us we're going to have a China issue even after Xi Jinping passes from the stage.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, the thought that I had when I read the chapter, Hal, was what does a policymaker, you know, in the sit room, who's trying to put together a strategy to deal with a country like China, what does that policymaker need from the intelligence community in order to put together, you know, an effective strategy? And I'm asking this question, obviously, because this is Intelligence Matters, and a lot of our listeners are current intelligence officers or folks in college who want to be intelligence officers. How do you think about that? If you were the National Security Advisor putting together a strategy on China, what would you want to know from the intelligence community?
Well, there are the things that it would be great to know, but are probably not reasonable to ask the IC to deliver. And so, look, in a perfect world, you would always want to have the 6 months of strategic warning about an adversary doing bad things that the U.S. apparently had in the run-up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, right? You would want to be able to, you know, read the mail of the Kremlin or in Zhongnanhai or wherever your adversary happens to be sitting. That's really hard. I mean, the U.S. intelligence community does it as well as anybody, but it's really hard. I think the things that you would want to have at a bare minimum would be a proper understanding of, you know, what during the Cold War we would have called Soviet strategic intentions, right? So what is it that the other side, China in this case, wants? What is the type of world that it wants to bring about? How does it see its own trajectory in global affairs? How does it view its relationship with the U.S.? You want to have answers to kind of those big picture questions about what the adversary wants and where it wants the world to go, because that's indispensable to knowing, you know, what degree of detente may be possible with Beijing now or Moscow during the Cold War. To what extent is this confrontation, you know, baked into the nature of the Chinese system or whatever the case may be? Those sound like big academic questions, but I think they're actually crucial to making good policy. And then the second piece of it is you want to know as much as you can about capabilities and about the other side's understanding of those capabilities, which are not always the same thing. And I think this is particularly important now at a time when the military balance in the Western Pacific is changing rapidly. So just to give one statistic that I like to point out, if you look at DOD's China Military Power Report for 2023 and you do a little bit of math, you pretty quickly come to the conclusion that China added 400 fourth generation aircraft to its inventory last year. That's sort of 400 F-16 equivalents. That's a lot of aircraft, right? The military balance is changing quickly in the Western Pacific. China's building up its nuclear forces as well. So you want to know what is the nature of those capabilities and what opportunities do they potentially provide the other side to engage in mischief? But equally important, and in some ways this is harder, you know, what does Xi Jinping think of those capabilities? How good does he think the PLA is? Because that's ultimately going to play a really important role in figuring out what level of risk he's willing to run in his relations with the United States.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of a discussion with Hal Brands.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
As you think about China, and given everything you know about strategy and the history of strategy, what do you think are the key elements of an effective U.S. strategy toward China? And do you think we're close to that today, or do you think there's a bit of a gap?
I think the good news is that we have built out a number of important elements of a China strategy over the past 6 to 7 years, which indicates, by the way, that there is a certain bipartisan continuity in U.S. strategy toward China, because a lot of what the Biden administration has done very constructively has often been building on Trump administration initiatives. And so the Biden administration, for instance, has really elevated the ambition and the significance of the Quad, this group that includes the U.S., Australia, Japan, and India over its 3 years in power. But it was the Trump administration that sort of helped bring the Quad back from the dead in 2017, 2018. So there is some continuity there. And if you look at U.S. strategy, you can see a handful of areas where I think the U.S. has started to put together some fairly constructive policies. We see some more aggressive technological denial policies, focusing on areas like AI and semiconductors. I think that's an important part of a long-term technological competition with China. You see the U.S. working very hard, particularly under the Biden administration, to fortify, expand, improve the coalitions that it has at its disposal to push back against the malign use of Chinese power. It's not just the Quad, it's AUKUS, it's the U.S.-Japan alliance, it's the U.S.-Japan ROK trilateral arrangement, and so on and so forth. You see this web of U.S. relationships that's taking shape to constrain the way that China uses power in the Indo-Pacific in particular. You see the reorientation of the intelligence community and the law enforcement community to pay more attention to Chinese intentions and capabilities, as well as Chinese influence operations in the U.S. and elsewhere. And so you see a bunch of places where there's really good stuff happening. There are at least two areas that I am pretty worried about. One is sort of what we might call foreign economic policy, where the U.S. has struggled really since about 2015, 2016, to devise a regional economic policy in the Indo-Pacific that would help countries address the problem of their economic dependence on China. We had something for this. It was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was supposed to link the U.S. more closely to a bunch of countries around the Pacific Rim. But long story short, both parties basically turned against that. And so some lesser efforts by the Biden administration notwithstanding, there's just not a whole lot there right now. The second area that I worry about basically has to do with the military balance. I think that the U.S. is in a great position for a long-term competition with China. I would much rather have America's problems than China's domestic problems once you take into account the economic slowdown, the demographic challenges, and a host of other issues. The challenge is that, as I mentioned, the military balance in the Western Pacific is shifting. It's shifting in potentially dangerous ways. And so I worry that the U.S. and its allies are not moving with the alacrity that would be necessary to shore up that balance of power in the latter half of this decade, which is the period when I think Xi Jinping may be most tempted to use force on Taiwan or on other issues there.
Yeah. Now let's switch to Iran. Chapter 40 in the book speaks to irregular warfare, which is obviously a big part of Iran's strategy toward Israel and toward the U.S. presence in the Middle East. And I'm wondering, how can that chapter and perhaps other chapters in the book inform what our strategy toward Iran should be? You know, obviously, we seem to be struggling with that a bit.
Yeah, I think that's a nice, polite understatement. And that chapter was written by Seth Jones, who is a scholar here in D.C., who has been one of Washington's leading defense intellectuals for a couple of decades now. And it looks at a handful of practitioners of irregular warfare, one of whom was Qasem Soleimani, so the head of the Quds Force of Iran's IRGC, who was killed in a U.S. drone strike about 4 years ago at the beginning of 2020, in circumstances that actually weren't so unlike the situation the U.S. faces today. Soleimani had really played the leading role in building this foreign legion of proxy forces that Iran works with throughout the Middle East, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, a variety of groups in Iraq and Syria. And he was trying to arrange, as far as we can tell from published reports, a series of attacks against U.S. facilities and personnel in the region when the decision was made to remove him from the battlefield, so to speak. The reason this is relevant, of course, is that the U.S. is dealing with a pretty similar challenge right now. And so you have the Houthis who are taking shots at shipping in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. You have Kataib Hezbollah and other Iranian-backed groups in Iraq that are taking shots at U.S. military facilities in Iraq, Syria, and Jordan, where they killed three U.S. personnel last month. And you have a very disordered regional scene as a result of all this. I think one of the things you have to recognize once you read the chapter is that the use of proxy forces is deeply ingrained in Iranian strategy. It is a strategy of asymmetric warfare against a superior power, which is the United States, or in some cases, Israel. It is a strategy that allows Iran to exercise influence in the region without having the traditional power projection military capabilities that would allow one to do that. And so there's probably no U.S. strategy that will simply get Iran to stop arming, stop training, stop assisting these proxy forces in one way or another. What you can do, I think, is try to raise the cost to Tehran of doing this and doing so in ways that prove most disruptive, that kill U.S. Service members, for instance. And I think to do that, unfortunately, you have to be a bit more willing to attack Iranian assets as opposed to simply attacking the proxies. That the point of using proxies, after all, is that from Iran's perspective, they are more or less expendable. The sort of effect of the Soleimani strike was to show that the U.S. would hold the Iranian leadership responsible for its proxies' actions. So that's probably a part of a strategy to push back against Iranian influence in the region. The caution I should offer, though, is that If you're willing to throw that punch, you better be ready for the counterpunch. Because after the U.S. killed Soleimani, Iran responded by firing off a bunch of ballistic missiles at Al-Asad Air Base in western Iraq, where U.S. personnel were stationed. And it was more luck than anything else that when those missiles impacted, they only gave a bunch of U.S. troops concussions rather than sending a bunch of them home in body bags. And had that happened, I think we would have been off to the races with a bigger U.S.-Iran confrontation. And so the U.S. does have the ability to escalate. It has the ability to use force in ways that really hurt the Iranians. But we shouldn't be under any illusion that that will be sort of the end of the exchange.
Yeah, boy, it really is a lesson in how difficult it is to make policy at the end of the day, right? With that kind of dealing with that kind of trade-off, and North Korea, Chapter 41 goes into detail, you know, with regard to the strategy over the years of the Kim family. North Korea just made a fairly significant change in policy toward the South. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are with regard to, is that change in policy consistent with their long-term strategy, or is this a shift in their long-term strategy?
Well, that chapter is written by Sumi Terry, who is one of America's leading North Korea analysts, and she knows a lot more about it than I do. Unfortunately, she has just weighed in on this issue in a great article in Foreign Affairs that everybody should read. And the short version, which I agree with, is that the changes that you're referencing and sort of North Korea's policy toward unification with the South, they are probably not signs that North Korea is getting ready to launch a big war against the South, as a few North Korea watchers have warned. For the simple reason that if North Korea was getting ready to do that, then it wouldn't make much sense to be selling a million rounds of artillery ammunition to Russia. You would need that stuff. And so I am a little bit more sanguine about where things will end up in that sense. But I do think what's coming is you're going to see greater North Korean provocations, greater North Korean coercion below the threshold of outright war. Because what's happening is that the North Korean nuclear and missile arsenals are getting to a place where they can plausibly threaten to overwhelm the limited U.S. missile defense assets in the region and then the missile defense shield that the U.S. has for North America. And so you'll have a North Korea that has greater confidence that if things somehow escalate, it can threaten to hit the U.S. homeland in one way or another. And so that may not encourage North Korea to start a big catastrophic war, but I think it will encourage it to push harder below the threshold. And we've seen this in the past. So back in 2010, a North Korea, basically a midget submarine, sank a South Korean ship and killed something like 45 South Korean sailors. So these provocations can be quite violent. And when you go to Seoul, I was there a few months ago, you really do pick up a deep concern that the North Korean nuclear problem is getting worse, that the U.S. and South Korea don't have any particularly good answers to solving the extended deterrence problem. And so while we haven't heard a ton from North Korea since the Fire and Fury episodes in 2017 and 2018, we should probably expect this agenda to consume more U.S. attention in the years ahead.
Hal, one final question. We're struggling, I think, as a nation. I think it's reflected in the policies of the last few administrations with how to think about the proper U.S. role in the world. And there's a chapter on John Quincy Adams, which I think kind of speaks eloquently to this. Can you share that with us?
That chapter was written by Charlie Adell, who is an old friend of mine from grad school, a very good scholar, occasional co-author of mine as well. And I think the point that he is making is that America's most far-seeing strategic thinkers and statesmen saw a really important global future for the United States, even when the United States was sort of this fledgling republic that was struggling to survive during the post-revolutionary era and the War of 1812. And people like John Quincy Adams, in some ways, laid the groundwork for the globally engaged, globally assertive America that would emerge during the 20th century by helping the United States expand across the North American continent, for instance, by helping to push other powers like Spain off of North America and create more running room for the United States in a way that eventually allowed it to project power globally as well. And the reason perhaps that that is so relevant today is that over the past 80 years or so, Americans have lived in the world that people like John Quincy Adams made possible. And that's a world that is increasingly structured by American power. It is a world where stability is provided in key regions by U.S. alliances and forced deployments. It's a world where the international economy is stabilized and lubricated by the United States. It's a world where democratic values are promoted and strengthened by the United States. And in some ways, I think we have come to regard that world as normal, to think that a world that is relatively peaceful, prosperous, and where democracy remains the dominant form of government, to think that that is the natural state of global affairs. I think people like John Quincy Adams would tell you that is not at all the case. That is a profoundly abnormal state of affairs. And it only reflects the fact that the United States has tried so hard to shape the world in those ways during the 20th and 21st centuries. And so the implication, of course, is that if the United States decides to forsake that global role, if it decides to revert to, you know, a much more isolationist or inward-looking posture, don't expect the world to stay the same. The world will start reverting to its more normal state, which is actually a much uglier state.
I think that's a great place to leave it, Hal. The editor is Hal Brands. The book is The New Makers of Modern Strategy. Hal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
That was Hal Brands. I'm Michael Morrell. Please rate and review the podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. And please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.